There's a fundamental capitalistic idea, which you know, is kind of axiomatic in Kabbalah, even though it's kind of it's not precise, which is that there are 600,000 letters in the Torah corresponding to 600,000 Jews in left Egypt. The problem is there aren't 600,000 letters in the Torah. There are only about 347,000.
Nor 600,000 people leaving Egypt.
What?
I said, nor were there 600,000 people leaving
Egypt. True, but 600,000 people were counted. So the it's questionable how you get up to 600,000. Some people want to say, well, you know, use some words have extra letters, or you double them. I don't know exactly how you make it up to it, but it's not really relevant. So it's not meant to be taken literally. But rather, it's meant to say that there is a congruence between the Jewish people and the Torah. Meaning that the Torah and the Jews are one entity. Hashem, in fact, when Kabbalah says, Yisrael, the Jews, Oraisa, Torah, the Kutchabichu, and God are all one entity. Not that they're all the same thing, but they're all congruent with one another. They all have the same ideals, the same goals, and in different ways, the same concept. Meaning, we don't know Hashem's content, but we know Hashem's wisdom has granted us the Torah. And we know that the Torah is given to the Jewish people. And the Jewish people are created for the purpose of the Torah. And all those things go together. There is that triangle of Yisrael, Oraisa, Israel, Torah, and Hashem. Today when I was teaching in the modern Orthodox school, one of the kids that I was teaching today about, they really got riled up today because I talked to them about the difference for letters for a Besser. I don't know if I've ever spoken about it here. Letter of Besser about the difference between the Eastern European yeshivas and the yeshiva and the Frankfurt approach. Have you heard me speak about that?
I think so, yeah.
The Eastern European
yeshiva.
That's
the one in a thousand versus the
right.
Everyone's nice.
Right, so you heard that one also? In Lithuania,
yes.
No, okay. You want a dollar? Yeah, I've got it. I don't know, but you can have it. Good luck. Maybe some less. Yeah, maybe. So anyway, I told them that they really couldn't stand that. It's the Lithuanian yeshiva idea that one in a thousand, the education system is structured to produce the one giant and the other 999 are the price of that one giant, right? So the educational system is structured and the societal system is structured for that, producing that one giant, versus the highly structured, less intellectually challenging and less competitive system, which was in the Frankfurt milieu, which produced fine Balabatim who lived with proper law of heaven and proper meticulous observance of mitzvot, but were not great scholars. So these people, it's interesting, I have in this class girls and boys. And the girls, they could relate to the Lithuanian.
In the same class?
Yeah, this was in high school. It was seniors.
High school?
Yeah. You've been around here a long time. You haven't even contemplated that anymore. Neither can I. It's only, it's very common. But in any event, these girls have to be okay, but I teach 10th grade. The tumor is unbelievable. I'm thinking of leaving just because of the tumor.
Right.
Anyway, so the girls actually, but the boys were in the uproar. They couldn't, that's ridiculous. How could it be that the world is created for the one, the few, the philosophers, and all that kind of stuff? The elitists. Okay. But anyway, so I explained that according to the Rambam, the world was created for the elite, the few, the philosophers. And the Rambam asked, why were all the morons created? Do you remember that? Do you remember the question? It's striking a vague chord, right?
Yeah.
And the Rambam answers two answers. He says that either because even philosophers are lonely and they need human companionship, or for that matter, you know, leaders need people to lead, or the second answer is that they would have to do their own cooking, cleaning, sowing, planting, harvesting, you know, what would that have to be philosophers? So therefore, God made everybody else to do their task for them. Boy, they love that one. So Rabbi Yudah Levi says differently. Rabbi Yudah Levi in the Kuzari says that the world was created for the purpose of the Jewish nation. A nation is a complex organism.
That appeals to them.
What?
The nation
appeals to them, right. Except one person. And what do you think he was bothered by? Think politically correct.
He was bothered by nationalism.
He was by the right. What about
xenophobic nationalists?
What is it?
You should have asked them to do your dishes right after you said that other thing.
So yeah, by what role there for non-Jews in this scheme? So I explained to him, well, the non-Jews in the Judeo-Levy scheme are there to be led by the Jewish nation. He didn't like that either. But in fact, that is the concept, which is that non-Jews and Jews are all regarded, since the time of the Tower of Babel, as nations opposed to individuals. And just like when you have individuals, there's an individual who's the leader and then the individuals who are the followers, so too you have nations, there is the leading nation, which is supposed to be a shining example and an inspiration to all the other nations. And that's the way the prophet depicts the ideal utopian vision of the world, of, you know, the eventual days of the Mashiach, when the Jewish nation will illuminate the world and everybody will follow in the footsteps of the Jews.
You mean it's kosher? Oh, it's sugar-free, you can.
So the, so we're going to make a chocolate. So the, so that is, that's really what it's supposed to be like. In other words, there's nations, and the Jewish nation is supposed to be the leading nations upon among the nations. You know, the shining example, not everybody, not everybody has become Jewish, but of course, but people should be God-serving, whatever religion they ultimately choose to follow. Right, which we assume is the B'nai Noach religion. So the so what the Kabbalistic approach is that Torah and the Jews are supposed to lead the world in unison, meaning that the Torah is the blueprint for the Jews, and the Medrash says at the beginning of Bereishis, Istakel Baraita Ubara Alma. God looked into the Torah and created the world. The Torah is the blueprint of the world as well. Therefore, for example, the way Reb Yerucham, the Mir Mashgiach, before the war, explains it, it's not because we have a father and mother that we have the mitzvah of kibud av v'aim, the mitzvah to honor them, but rather because the wisdom of the Torah decrees that there should be a mitzvah to respect the father and mother. Therefore, the concept of mother and father were created. In other words, the cause and effect is reversed, right? The wisdom of Hashem saw that a human being will be developed to the utmost possible extent that he has a father and mother to honor, so therefore fathers and mothers were created. The whole, you know, reproductive system was created. Not because there was a father and mother was the mitzvah of kibud av v'aim given. So if that's the case, so really, the Torah being the blueprint of the world, and the Torah being the tool by which the Jewish people are supposed to, ideally speaking, lead the world, that there's another step actually to take, which I left out, which is the system approach, the Nefesh HaChayim system approach, which you don't necessarily have to employ here, but it does help things. Those of you who recall when we talked about the Nefesh HaChayim, most of us don't talk about Nefesh HaChayim. Did you think about that recently? Everything flows together in my mind. I don't know where it talks about what. The Nefesh HaChayim, the Chaim Volozhiner, says that the world is a closed system. How does that work, a closed system? You do a mitzvah, the world is elevated. It's fixed. It's uplifted. More blessing comes to the world, both spiritual and physical. You do an aveva, the world is destroyed, ruined, right? More spiritual defilement comes into the world is physically afflicted as well. So every time a Jew does a mitzvah, not just if he does it the right way, you know, not just because he happens to do a mitzvah, but he does it sincerely and fully, so the whole creation is uplifted. Every time a Jew does an aveva, the whole creation is diminished. The Chaim Volozhiner says only Jews have this capacity, because this capacity is hardwired into the system of Jews and Torah. Meaning, Torah is the blueprint of the world, right? So therefore, the Torah is, the way Reb Sotik puts it, also the map of the world. As the it's all both the blueprint and the map, and since it's both the blueprint and the map, so therefore, when the Jews learn the Torah, so they're actually, the Jews learn the Torah, they're actually changing the map or constantly redefining the map of the world. Now again, that means not just that when Hashem...
The Torah is the blueprint of the world, really.
Oh, okay, thank you. The radical tendencies are right. The Torah is an ongoing developing thing. That's a very important point to make in this respect. Meaning that Torah is not static. There's more Torah today than there was yesterday. There'll be more Torah tomorrow than there is today. Not just because the new Sfarim being published every day. Because Torah is not just what's published and, you know, and it's true that several Sfarim are published every day and Torah gets larger and larger. But rather, the very discussion of Torah, the very learning of Torah, our gathering here today expands the frontiers of Torah. Meaning whenever somebody gets together, Jewish people get together, and learn or discuss Torah, or for that matter, learn Torah, to learn by themselves, the frontiers of Torah are expanded. Things are growing. That's particularly true in Torah Baal Peh, and Torah only true in Torah Baal Peh, not in Torah Bitzvah. Torah Bitzvah, the written Torah, is static. It's set. It's etched in stone. Not only that, Torah Shabbat, the written Torah, is accessible also to non-Jews. Non-Jews are supposed to, were specifically given access to the written Torah. That's why when they entered the land of Israel, it was translated into 70 languages. And that is just as much the universal property of the world as it is of ours. But Torah Shabbat, the oral law, that's only the Jews. And in fact, the Goy, according to Halacha, if he's willing to keep Halacha, is not supposed to learn the parts of Torah which are not relevant to him as a non-Jew. Meaning he can learn everything which is in the Torah which has to do with non-Jews. Right? Which is all the written Torah and some parts of the oral Torah. He can also learn things which have to do with ethics. Because we want everybody to be ethical and moral human beings. But he can't learn, let's say, you know, can't learn the Sefes, let's say, Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah you can't learn because what if you have to do with Rosh Hashanah? On the Sefes Shabbos? What if you have to do with Shabbos? It's not him. So therefore, he's not allowed to learn it. Now is he not allowed to observe Shabbos? So he's not allowed to learn about Shabbos.
You know, he's not learning about it?
We kill
him. We don't kill him.
Oh.
it's not punishable by death in the hands of a human court. The Chazal say, Yitzchai Nisa B'day Shemayim, God will smite him down there, but God sometimes has other considerations.
So Ron gets a half a point, though.
That's about half a point. It was partially correct. So why is that? Because, again, from a mystical perspective, we understand that Torah is linked to the Jewish soul. The Jewish soul is hardwired to produce, to develop, to understand, and to grow in Torah. And that Jewish soul, when it does it, creates new vistas on the map of the world. Because it expanded the map. So therefore, for example, let's say today you consider some Torah context for a long, long time. You sat here for like 10, 15 minutes, and all of a sudden it came up with a tremendous new insight. A brilliant idea. So that is, I don't know if that's precisely what's going to happen, but according to this perspective, when you do that, a volcano might erupt somewhere in the Pacific as a result of your Kiddush, as a result of your novel idea, and form a new island. Why is that? Again, because since Torah has just been expanded by your new insight, the world has just been changed. Not just spiritually, but also physically. The map of the world has been redefined.
What about things in space too? Like if I do an Avera, does that mean a supernova is going to go off somewhere and blow up? Or if I do a mitzvah, like some planet's going to form?
Yes, it could be. Right. It doesn't necessarily matter if it's limited to Earth. Right. It could be in the heavens, but in creation, that's what I meant to say. When we say it's the map of the world, doesn't necessarily mean the world is limited to the Earth, but the world, the entire world. You take a look at the top of this page here, it says, we know that the illumination is quoted from the Torah Kachayim. We know that the illumination of Jewish souls is the illumination of the Torah. As it is said that Yisrael is an acrostic. Yesh, Shishim, Ribo, Otios, LaTorah. There are 600,000 letters to the Torah. The Jews in each generation therefore comprise the current map of the world. New phenomena in the Jewish nation in any generation will create corresponding new phenomena in the structure of the world. One jump is enough for today. Okay, go outside and play. Okay? Now outside the building. I'm saying, in the building. So the table of the next paragraph, the idea is not fully a Hasidic one. Rabbi Elio Meir Bloch Vassal writes that when the Torah was given to Israel, the characteristics of its nature were part of the Torah's stages. They, through their thoughts, determined the characteristics of nature, which follows the logic and secrets of their Torah. They decide the reality of Torah and the reality of the creation linked to the Torah. What is the cause and what is the effect? The cause is not the reality, which demands the effect of figuring out relevant halachos. On the contrary, the cause is halacha, and the effect is the reality of the world. Now, in the footnote, I bring down an example, which is really more of an isolated example. I don't think it's necessarily a good proof for this, but it's interesting. The Gemara says, it's actually the Yerushalmi, it says, the halacha is that if a girl under 3 years old is raped, you know, so she remains a virgin. Why? Because whatever part of the body that is, it regenerates itself. Right? So, you know, the sack of blood in that place regenerates itself, and she remains, she has the status still of a woman who never had relations. After the age of 3, it doesn't come back. Once it's gone, it doesn't regenerate itself. So the Yerushalmi asks, you know, wait a minute. In halacha, 3 years old is not necessarily always the same time. Because we know that the lunar year has 364 days, and therefore sometimes, like this year, we have to make a leap month to catch up. So what happens if this girl was born in, you know, if within these girls 3 years of age, there's a leap month, there's an additional month. How does that work? Do we say that until 3, including that extra month, it would regenerate? Or is it think only till 3, meaning 36th month, not a 37th month, does it regenerate? So the Yerushalmi says, amazing statement. Yerushalmi says, God follows the calendar as set by Chazal. Nature follows the calendar as set by Chazal. If they decide that one of these years is a leap year, 37 months, so therefore, it's 37 months, and the nature is changed by that leap year. Now, you don't have to say that, because you can say it's 3 solar years. And 3 solar years always comes out to about 37 Jewish months, right? Because 365 days a year, that leaves the remainder of 11 days. Within 3 years, it accumulates already to 30 days, 33 days, right? So therefore, they could have answered, that it's because it's solar years. But that's not what they answer. They answer because the Luni, the Chazal, Hashem follows what the rabbis decree. Yeah.
What happens if, Chas v'Shalom, a girl 2 years old, gets raped and then it doesn't grow back, or vice versa, if like a girl who's, 12-year-old and then it does grow back?
You don't check.
You just assume that this is what happens.
But if the girl's 2, and then she gets up and gets married, they're going to know that she's still a virgin if it grew back.
Okay.
Or if it didn't grow back, then the husband could claim that she's not a virgin, and then...
Yeah, and all sorts of ramifications would follow.
Right.
Good point. Right. So I guess that... I don't know. I guess with our assumption that it never happens if it doesn't grow back. You're right. I mean, because it could be that occasionally it doesn't, but a case which is really an exception, is still an exception to a rule.
Right.
So again, that doesn't apply to everything, and there's a special derivation, which is used in order to teach us that the rabbis have control over the calendar. Meaning Hashem gave the rabbis the power to determine the calendar, perhaps they didn't give them the power to determine reality in anything else. But you know what? Everybody would agree to one thing, which is that the rabbis have the capacity, perhaps not to determine physical reality like what Tzadik and Rebellion may have lost it, but they determine halachic reality. Halach is an abstract concept. And the reality of halacha is not the reality of reality. The reality of halacha is the reality of the halachic system. By that I mean, for example, let me give you an example. There's halacha, which is one of the most controversial issues. In Judaism, is life. L-I-C-E. Why is life one of the most controversial issues in Judaism?
Because Prabhupada says that they regenerate on their own and you're allowed to kill them on Shabbos.
Right.
And then we know now that they lay eggs.
Right. The Talmud says that you're allowed to kill lice on Shabbos. Why? Because lice reproduce asexually. It's through spontaneous,
just spontaneous generation.
Spontaneous generation. And therefore, they're not considered to be live, and therefore you're allowed to kill them on Shabbos. So there's this 17th century source, or 18th century source, Rabbi Yitzchak Pomponati, who lives in Italy, who said that, well, now that science has advanced, you know, they developed microscopes and are able to see that lice reproduce sexually, so that law changes, and you're no longer allowed to kill lice on Shabbos. But most of the later authorities told him he was wrong. Now, there's several possible reasons why he would be wrong. But I think the reason why he's wrong is because it is the rabbis who determine the halachic reality. Even if they are mistaken, it's like the lawyer can tell you, a law which is based on a mistake is still a law while upon the books. Is that correct?
I'm not really familiar with that concept.
In other words, a law which is basically, in the state of Israel, they have this issue because the state of Israel has no constitution. Right, so all law, and has no independent body of law. So you have laws that stretch back to the British Mandate, to Ottoman times, and then you have modern Israeli law, and the law follows all three systems simultaneously. So that's why it's a big mess. So you have laws, which were written in the 1800s, which are archaic from one perspective, but nevertheless, they're still the law, and you have to follow those laws. The same thing here. The rabbis create the law of reality. It's the rabbis who Hashem delegated the authority to make determinations have determined that their ruling on this matter is that it's permissible. It's the law of reality. That's what you do. Until another Sanhedrin or another, you know, set of sages of the stature of the authors of the Talmud come along and say, no, it's not true. But since, by definition, since this Talmud was closed, we don't have any sages on the level of those sages of the Talmud. So therefore, whatever they determine remains the halachic reality for all time. And you cannot change that reality because we no longer have the tools to change it. The tools which we would have to have would be the bona fide smicha, which we lost, the real smicha, which we lost in the 400s, or alternatively, a representative body which represents the totality of the Jewish people. Which ain't going to happen there. I mean, all the Jewish rabbis being represented. It's possible to represent all the Jewish people, but it's not possible to represent all the Jewish rabbis. So all the so you have to represent all of them together, and then you'd be able to change the law. But that's the way the law functions. The law that loves its reality is a reality unto itself.
Do we have to strive to get that group of rabbis?
You know, we're close. That's the Sanhedrin business. It's very, you know, the new Sanhedrin. They were trying to do it. Not happening.
You should join.
The Rambam says that he does not anticipate it happening before Mashiach comes. He doesn't say why, but it's clear that the reason why is because you won't be able to get all the Jews to agree before Mashiach comes on anything.
So do we have an obligation to try?
Yes. Good luck.
Go. So you're saying that if a rabbi of the Talmud said, I need to make a halakha on something, and I'm going to make the halakha based upon this scientific information that I know, and then that's the halakha. And then later, after the Talmud's closed, when you see that it wasn't his fault, but that's just not the reality, then it doesn't matter.
Right. Okay. So the system is a closed system in and of itself. It's not referential. I mean, ideally speaking, it should be referential to science. But once the law is enacted, even on the basis of bad science, it still remains the law, so somebody else comes and overturns the law.
Does that hold true for later day halacha tshuvas?
So that's the question. To what point does it hold true? In other words, does it hold true for what Reb Moshe Feinstein says? Right?
Right.
So that's what
like electricity on Shabbos.
I think yes. But let's discuss it further. So, going further here, I bring down here in the third paragraph, or the fourth paragraph, let us know that Rebellion Mayor is cabinet. Rebellion Mayor Bluff says something later on, which he says, if it is in line, with the, which follows, actually says on top, which follows with the logic and secrets of the Torah. And so elsewhere makes a similar remark. When one is mechadish, one comes up with a novel idea, with a matter in Torah, one must not do so with any negiah vested personal interest in his heart. No, that is, when he wants the matter to turn out so, or so, for the sake of his pride, or to argue to another, etc. One's chiddush must stem solely from one's yearning to know the truth. If a person follows these guidelines, then even if he makes a mistake, his words are words of Torah, and Dibur Elokim Chaim, the words of the living God. That's an amazing statement that Sardis is making. And Sardis is saying is that if a person has reached the level of being a great Torah scholar, and this is more very important, he has no axe to grind. He's not really thinking subjectively, but objectively, then what he says has inherent validity. By definition, the very fact that he says it gives it the validity in and of itself. Now, this is a really, if you can take this, it's a very radical extent. Because then you can say, you know, when Moshe Feinstein said something, he was a great scholar, and so, even if his reasoning is wrong, like I said about the rabbis perhaps in the time of Talmud, that becomes halacha, right? To that! And then we will have a system which is totally divorced from, not just actual reality, but even from halacha reality. Because the person could come and say, well, listen, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, maybe he's right about his logic, but he's Rabbi Moshe, and he said it sincerely, and he didn't have any vested interest, and he's a great man, so therefore Allah should follow him. That's what somebody might say. Now, the answer is, can a person say that? The answer is, yes, a person may say that.
Don't Chassidim say it about the Rebbe?
Yes, and you could say that about Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, or, for that matter, any rabbi who you accept upon yourself as your own rabbi. Because only a rabbi, and rabbi don't mean somebody has smicha. We learned last week that smicha nowadays is I wouldn't even call it a joke. That would be giving it too much respect. But a rabbi, meaning somebody who's a scholar, can't necessarily trust the scholarship of another rabbi. You shouldn't necessarily trust it. You should try and understand it and question it and deal with it on a lovely level. But a simple person doesn't have that responsibility. Why? Because that's not your training. If you don't have the training, it's not your business. You rely on the opinion issued by the person who you follow normally, the person to whom you ask your question. If he says, let's say, that this is mutter, then you're allowed to follow that. It's interesting. I think that makes sense, right? Because a lay person is actually not required to check out the details of a ruling he gets from a rabbi. So if the rabbi gives him the wrong ruling, it's not his problem. He follows that ruling.
What about, like, for instance, you see a Rambam says that taking money for Torah, like basically being a kolo student, is very, 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 very bad. And that it's usher. So, and then later authorities say, no, it's mutter. So the thing is, can someone say, I want to do all my halakhas like Rambam? And I don't care what the Gadol Hador of this generation says, I don't care what anyone says, I don't care what any Akron says, I'm just going to follow Rambam, and for anything that he doesn't say that doesn't pertain to a certain halakha that I need a question for, then I'll go to my local rabbi.
That's an interesting question. In other words, can somebody like stretch back over the generation, go way back to Rambam and say, you know what? All the rabbis can find the Rambam, not for me. I want to go back to the Rambam and observe a long standard of the Rambam.
Is that what Yemenites do, I heard? Or?
No, but Yemenites are different there because they never have any updates.
Right.
That's the difference. Actually, that's because there is different. I discuss this later on. But it's basically, you know, it's like, I guess we could use a computer analogy, which is that if you have a machine which is constructed to run a certain which is constructed to run Windows XP, you can't necessarily go back to DOS and run it, run the machine on DOS. Your CD-ROM, your CD drive won't work, your DVD certainly won't work, all sorts of things will fail to function. Meaning there's certain times in Jewish history when there were certain upgrades made which became definitive. Not so often. Oh, as a matter of fact, there was one primary one, and that took place in the 1500s. What's the definitive update?
Protein press?
What?
Continue.
Oh,
the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch was the definitive update, because everybody except the Shulchan Aruch, because they had both the Sfarim, Rabbi Zakara, and the Ashkenazim, and Moshe Ilish, and it went through, it was accepted by Jews the world over. So actually, something was to stay in the Shulchan Aruch, either for the Ashkenazim or Sfarim or both, became definitive and normative, and you can't go back beyond that.
The Mishnah Berurah sometimes wavers from...
The Mishnah Berurah never wavers unless there's an earlier commentator on the Shulchan Aruch rather than the Shulchan Aruch.
But that earlier commentator also argued on the Shulchan Aruch.
So there was a window of opportunity. Right? A window of opportunity, which we think ended around the time of the Vilna Gaon. That's what we see happen. Which about 150 years after the, maybe 200 years after the Shulchan Aruch was written, it was still, you know, there was still some question as to issues in the Shulchan Aruch. But after that time, you won't find anybody. After the Vilna Gaon time, you won't find anybody who argues on the Shulchan Aruch. Why is that? Because again, the Shulchan Aruch plus, you know, the earlier commentary became definitive. And therefore that determines halacha for all time.
Is one allowed to, if one is Ashkenazi, are they allowed to rely on the Sephardic sections of parts of Shulchan Aruch if they want to?
So Rabbi Zakeh told you to undertake a conversion ceremony to become a Sephardi.
Really?
Yeah.
How do you do that?
You go and renounce certain things which have the status of a vow, like not these rights on Pesach, and you'll accept upon yourself certain things which, you know, the Sephardim are stringent about, like true
Slichos
block kosher. What?
Like Slichos and every day.
Yeah,
like
Slichos every day for Elul, or that's the worst part of being a Sephardim. Like Ramadan, I know it's worse, getting up early, fasting for 40 days straight, and saying Slichos for 40 days straight. What? No, I can't even contemplate that. So there's certain things, and then I guess they pronounce you, they sprinkle some holy water. they make you a Sephardi, and you can then eat rice.
Sounds interesting.
So the Sephardim holy can actually convert to Sephardiism. Could the Ashkenazim holy also convert to Ashkenazism, but I've never seen it written down explicitly.
I don't think they require a conversion ceremony. I think they just expect you to.
Right. So the bottom line is that when a person determines halacha, and if he's not normative, meaning that he's not the Shulchan Aruch or the Ramah, it's set the norm for all time, then he's still subject to arguments. And sometimes you can't tell, for example, the Mishnah Berurah, you can't tell, it's too early to tell if the Mishnah Berurah will be accepted authoritative, as the authoritative commentary of the Shulchan Aruch, like the Shulchan Aruch was accepted as authoritative in its time. I don't think it will. But it's possible that someday the Mishnah Berurah will be accepted on that level. And then we'll say, well, the early generations after the Mishnah Berurah, like the Chazanish, have the capacity to argue the Mishnah Berurah, but we no longer have the capacity to argue the Mishnah Berurah, and therefore, Mishnah Berurah plus the Chazanish, that's definitive for us. In fact, nowadays they publish Mishnah Berurah very openly with the Chazanish. Oh, usually with the Chazanish in the back. So, that would be a case in which Hashem, or the case in which, Hashem, or the tailor the reality of the world to reflect that update, and then you couldn't go back beyond that.
Someone, even if there's an update that for some reason the generation sinks to a low level and makes an update that's accepted universally, so to speak, but one person really, really thinks that it's the wrong way to go and wants to rely on earlier sources, they can't?
They're not
able to.
That one person can press, but not a kid.
What?
That one person press, yes, but not a kid.
What do you mean?
If that one person, let's say he, if you know you're the generation which is determining the norm, so it may well be that you are allowed to continue living the way you lived previously until the end of your days. Mm-hmm. But your children will be already bound by the norm. You know what I'm saying?
No.
The new norm.
The new norm, yeah.
The new norm. How do you know if you're living in the time of the norm?
The time of the norm is established?
It's established.
I don't know. That's what I'm saying. You can't think it'd be binding on you because the norm has to be established, and it probably is only established usually after some time has elapsed.
So right now, Shulchan Aruch is universal, and we have to follow everything Shulchan Aruch says, and we cannot go rely on the Rambam's ruling on anything.
Unless we're Yemenites. Why Yemenites? Because they were cut off from the Shulchan Aruch. The Yemenites never accepted the Shulchan Aruch because they were cut off from the Shulchan Aruch.
They lived in Yemen, and time stopped right now. The clock stopped with the Rambam. I'm not going to say literally. But you know, the halachic clock stopped. The Shulchan Aruch was accepted by those Sephardim, but not by the Yemenites. And they were allowed as a community to retain their own standards, because as a result, they could retain their modern-day standards.
So then there's two halachic realities today.
Yeah, but the Yemenites are fast fading for the general population.
Yeah.
It's not, it might not even be true anymore, but certainly it's not going to be true another 50 years. Because, you know, all Yemenites, the Yemenites are very few, and they're assimilated in the general Jewish population.
So it's impossible to say, if Rambam says one thing and Shulchan Aruch says something else, you can't go with the Rambam ever. Because Shulchan Aruch takes so much precedence.
Right. No. Now,
so why do we learn the Rambam?
What?
Why do we learn Rambam?
Because the Rambam was brilliant. And it developed our minds to learn Rambam.
That's all? Like when we compare, when we learn a Sugya in Gemara, we learn the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch and see how they differ and whatnot.
Well, that teaches us how to practice. That actually teaches us how the Rambam works.
Right.
In a specific area, whatever it is.
So whenever we read Rambam, we should say, oh, this is what the Rambam says, and that's nice, but we don't follow this.
When the push comes to shove, we have to see what the Shulchan Aruch says, exactly. So I'll tell you a little story, which somebody's not put in this article, but I don't know why. Mistake, but there's a story about Mechaim Brisker, Mechaim Soloveitchik, one of the greatest Torah sages at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century. And he was a rabbi of the town of Brisk, but he almost never used to issue halachic rulings. At the time, the rabbis were like these communal leaders, and they had under them Zionic judges who issued the actual day-to-day halachic rulings for the town. And when Reb Chaim had a big question which his Zion couldn't answer, his Zion's name was from Simcha Zelig Reader, so when his Zion couldn't answer it, so then he would send the question off to Rabbi Yitzchak Yochanan Sefer, who was the recognized great postmate of his generation, until he died in 1892. And the way the tradition has come down to us, Reb Chaim used to send a message to Rabbi Yitzchak Yochanan saying like this, listen Rabbi Yitzchak Yochanan, don't send me the psak, but don't send me the reason for the psak. Why? Because if I know the reason for the fact, I will almost always be able to disprove it. And then I won't know what to do. But this way, if I don't know the reason for the fact, so then I can follow it blindly and not have any questions about it. It's an interesting idea.
Who's burning in these situations?
What? The rabbi.
The rabbi burns.
The rabbi burns. But it doesn't work that way. That's the point. Because the rabbi, if the rabbi is a legitimate rabbi, and issues the fact based on legitimate guidelines, so nobody has to burn. Right? And the major thing is, of course, yes, if you are a Sephardi and you eat rice on Pesach, so you're going to heaven for enjoying Pesach that much more. If you're an Ashkenazi and you eat rice on Pesach, you're going to burn. Right?
Why not listening to the rabbis?
What?
Because you didn't listen to the rabbis?
You didn't listen
to some rabbis.
Right, but not the right one.
Who's to say the right ones?
That's because this divide of Ashkenazi and Sephardi became a division, again, in what became normative, what updates were followed in each part of the world.
But at the time of Mashiach, when the Jewish people are supposed to be one, then how can we have this halakhic division?
We're not supposed to be one at the time of Mashiach comes.
Or 12, or whatever.
Yeah. So it's highly possible this will continue to exist in this conflicted way. And we're going to, it's late, so we'll come back to the next week. But the question is why Hashem wanted to be this way, and we will explain the Amir Hashem next week. Okay, we'll talk to you.